Today on Wings, Asia Calling is a weekly news program based in Indonesia that has substantial coverage of women's issues. With permission, Wings has selected some of their stories for today's program. You'll hear about women's brave activities in Indonesia, North Korea, Pakistan, Afghanistan, East Timor, and the United States.
There's a river of birds in migration, a nation of women with wings.
Welcome to Wings, a series of news and current affairs programs by and about women around the world, produced and distributed by the Women's International News Gathering Service.
You're listening to Asia Calling. In Jakarta, freeways often feel like parking lots. The city is overrun with traffic jams, or macet, as it's called in Indonesia. But with the introduction of online ride-hailing apps like Gojek or GrabBike, more and more people are turning to motorcycle taxis to dodge the traffic and zip around the city. Nicole Kirby has this story on the women that are entering this male-dominated market.
Many Jakartans spend hours commuting each day, each way, morning and night. By far the fastest and cheapest way through the city is on motorbike. Many of us get around the city on Ojeks or motorcycle taxis. But until recently, of the hundreds of Ojek drivers I'd had, every single one of them was a man.
I never have a motorcycle taxi driver, a woman, ever.
I have twice the female driver, yeah.
Yeah, sometimes I found couples of female drivers.
Fajar takes an Ojek or motorcycle taxi several times a day.
And have you ever had a female driver?
I have a couple of times indeed. One time I remember vividly, the driver apologized that she was female. You know, you don't mind taking a female driver, do you? And I was like, well, of course not. I mean, why is it a problem? You know, I don't mind it whatsoever. And I've had female drivers probably 5 times, I would say, during the 2 years that I've used Gojek.
Even though they're hard to find, women drivers are out there.
Nama saya Rifka Kurniawan. Saya driver Grab wanita.
That's Rivka. She's been making her living as a motorcycle taxi driver for over a year.
Kadang-kadang ada customer yang enggak mau sih. Enggak mau sama.
There are many customers that don't want a female driver. They want to cancel. I have to say, don't cancel.
Kalau udah ketemu customer, kenapa, Pak? Jangan di-cancel, Pak. Kasihan juga, saya bilang gitu.
She loves the job, but says it's a daily struggle to be accepted on equal terms.
Tadi pagi ini saya juga nih ngalamin.
Just earlier this morning, I took an order and I hadn't yet met the customer. And they telephoned me and I was already at the place to pick them up. And then they asked to cancel. I said, what is the reason for asking to cancel? Is it because I'm a woman?
Dengan alasan sudah dijemput, jadi minta di cancel, saya bilang.
Well-worn stereotypes about female drivers are hard to break with.
Ada memang yang bilang seperti itu.
There are people that think that women drivers are still learning to drive, but that's just their opinion.
Kita juga nggak bisa salahin sih, gitu.
Wilhelmina, also a driver, agrees. Some men clearly find it confronting to take a ride from a woman, she says.
Laki-laki kadang saya datang, ya, Mbak.
Sometimes, if it's a man, they say they are embarrassed to drive with a woman and they don't want to sit at the back.
Nah, saya juga jarang banget, hampir tidak pernah.
Regular commuter Rizal told me that he was so used to having male drivers that the first time he got a woman driver, he felt uncomfortable. And so he asked her to sit at the back while he drove.
Tawarkan ke drivernya, Mbak. Biar saya aja yang di depan.
She refused, saya bawa motornya, but other female drivers let him
dia
drive.
Mau. Dia menolak.
Bu, saya aja yang bawa karena bukan muhrim, dia bilang gitu. Jadi
Wilhelmina and Rivka both say they sometimes let male passengers drive while they sit at the back, just so the passengers won't cancel and find a male driver instead. But when I asked women, they told me they'd prefer a female driver if they could choose. Here's Josta and Saiwan.
I think it's awesome if I have a motorcycle taxi driver as a woman.
I think it's more better to have a female driver than a male. Because like I don't feel scared to female drivers, right? Sometimes like they're asking like how old am I, like or where am I come from, like that. So scaring me. I would choose female driver.
Where sexual harassment is rife, there are good reasons why women prefer the rare find that is a female driver.
Like example, last time my motorbike driver asked me, where's your husband? And are you single or what? But oh my God, that's not your problem.
More and more women are becoming Ojek drivers, according to Rivka. She's organised a group for women drivers. It has more than 100 members and they're growing. And some men are starting to get more comfortable with women drivers. Wilhelmina told me a male passenger recently took a nap on the back of her bike as she zipped through the city. For Asia Calling, this is Nicole Kirby in Jakarta. In 2011, Suki Kim risked her life to live in North Korea, teaching English for 6 months at the Pyongyang University of Science and Technology, established by Christian missionaries. While the missionaries hoped to spread their religion, they were not allowed to utter a word about it. And so Suki Kim found herself living a life of secrecy, a journalist masquerading as a teacher, masquerading as a missionary. Born and raised in South Korea, Suki Kim has lived in America since her teenage years, but her personal connection to what she calls the troubling and fascinating world of North Korea has driven her to research and write about the country for over a decade.
Members of my family went missing during the Korean War, taken to North Korea, were from South Korea. This separation of families, however, is not that unusual for Koreans. You know, it affected millions of people. And I also needed to, make sense of that kind of loss for an entire generation. Korea's been divided 70 years. And what has happened to these lives and why North Korea is the way it is. And so there is definitely a family loss, personal loss, that drove me to, in quest of understand North Korea.
Since North and South Korea separated in 1945, South Korea has developed into a flourishing modern society and democracy. North Korea, on the other hand, has shut itself off from the world under the dictatorship of the Kim dynasty. Today, the country is ruled by its third Kim, 32-year-old Kim Jong-un, who took over from his father in 2011, just as Suki Kim was leaving the country. Over recent decades, millions of North Koreans have died due to extreme famine. Many more have been sent to prison camps or gulags for crimes against the regime. Gaining entry to North Korea and understanding life inside its closed walls is extremely difficult and risky. Preparing for the mission took years, and once there, secrecy was crucial.
I saved everything on USB sticks, erased everything from the laptop every single time. You know, starting a document within a document so that my book starts on page 100 of what looks like a lesson notes. You know, hiding a copy on SD card and then keeping it hidden in the room somewhere in the dark. All that step was necessary because, you know, it just, you're watched 24/7. If a minder's job, sole job is to watch over me, what would happen if those notes get fired? I mean, found out, then, you know, obviously, you know, we can kind of guess what would happen, but that would be really crimes against the state.
Yeah, it's actually terrifying to think what would have happened if they were found.
Yeah, I mean now later I can really reasonably look at that, but I do think it's a miracle I came out alive or I came out at all. We have had journalists go in as a part of package tour and stuff like that, but to actually live undercover amongst the, you know, North Koreans and keeping notes, 400-page notes that I kept in secret. So, I mean, that's never been done just because it just can't be done. I'm thankful I got out, but it was terrifying there every second of the day.
The extreme limits on freedom, liberty and thought, not to mention the lack of food or luxury items, is something everyone in North Korea is subjected to, Suki said. And not only outsiders or those living at the bottom rungs of society. Even the elite that she lived amongst had their movement controlled. Life in North Korea, she says, revolves around intense propaganda and a cult ideology.
You know, if you have a cult ideology and then you have the biggest army in the world, military dictatorship, you basically are controlling people from all angles. It's a system built on fear. And it's like you're controlling their soul if it's a cult ideology, and you control their physical movement, and you control their knowledge by basically censoring every possible of information going in, physically removing their right to travel within the country or out of the country. It's like it's covered on all aspects. It is really, when you think about it, the absolute way of an abuse and control.
And what interested me as well was even intimate relationships were policed.
I mean, I, you know, was not able to observe their relationship with their family, although they wrote letters to their family, which were also not delivered to the family because they couldn't even send any letters out. But what I observed of this kind of system, you know, friendship that was really kind of a buddy system of watching each other, so that two students always went everywhere together, which looked like best friends, but by living there, observing them close, I realized it was actually assigned to them. And things like they have a weekly meeting where they report on each other. So how much of that boundary is literally designed and mapped out and watched by their regime? I mean, that's just one area of how they manipulate and actually try to erase humanity, basic human rights.
I'm wondering about the ethical dilemmas that you had to face writing a book like this.
There was never a doubt that I had to write the book to the world. I felt it's a gulag nation. People are stuck there and their voice is not getting out for over 70 years. So an in-depth account of what's going on there psychologically, I'm not talking about a gulag stuff, which we can learn from defectors who escaped from there, but actual analysis of this nation having to reach the readers outside. No doubt about that. I think the ethical dilemma was actually more about my role there as a human being living with them, because I just love them and I wanted to tell them everything. And what knowledge would do to their fate, what truth would do if I were to tell them the truth that their great leader was actually the world's worst dictator and everything they've been taught have been lies. Now, what would that kind of discovery mean for them who are stuck in North Korea? And what kind of punishment, persecution they would have to suffer? And if not, what kind of unhappy life would that be, knowing what they can't have and their reality is all fake? And I felt if the ethical dilemma was more about that, because if I can't tell them the truth, what was I doing there?
For Asia Calling, that was journalist and writer Suki Kim in conversation with me, Nicole Kirby, in Ubud, Indonesia.
On Wings, you're listening to stories by and about women from the Indonesia-based media outlet Asia Calling.
You're listening to Asia Calling on KBR. As a guerrilla fighter, 61-year-old Madalena Suarez fought long and hard for the independence of Timor-Leste, the tiny half-island nation that was formerly occupied by Indonesia. And her bravery has not gone unnoticed. Suarez received an N Peace Award from the United Nations Development Programme in 2013 and has since become an inspiring role model for women in Timor-Leste. Reporter Teodosia Dos Reis has her story.
I met Madalena in her village, not far from the capital, Dili. The 61-year-old is also known by her code name, Kasian. In the local language, tetum, that means poor. But it had a double meaning for Madalena. As a guerrilla fighter, it referred both to how the Timorese was poorly equipped to fight against Indonesia, and also poor Madalena, who had to leave her family to go fight soldiers in the jungle. During the fight for independence, Madalena was a soldier for Falentil, the military of Timor-Leste. Here, she is explaining what it was like.
Ami a guerrilla de, ami siguranza ho kilat.
We were guerrilla fighters with the men, with weapons in our hands. At night, we tried to block off the enemy. When we fought against the Indonesian military, us women were ready. And when the Indonesian soldiers were shot, we would go and take the weapons.
Madalena says she didn't hesitate to join the guerrilla fighters. She was one of about 20 Timorese women that took up arms to fight for independence.
At the time, I was with the male soldiers. I fought like men because I didn't want my life to be tortured by the Indonesian military.
But these days, Madalena has picked a different fight. After Timor-Leste gained independence from Indonesia in 1999, Madalena decided to contribute to her new nation in a different way. Over the years, she built 5 kindergartens to help young Timorese children get an education. More than 30 children under the age of 6 attend the kindergartens before they go to primary school. Madalena says their kindergarten are part of an ongoing commitment to the country.
The struggle for independence was more than 24 years ago, but I intend to keep contributing to the development of the country. That's why I founded the schools, so that in the future the young generation will remember our struggle for the country's freedom and development.
Madalena funds the kindergartens with her modest veterans pension. Illiterate herself, education, she says, is the key to the country's development. And if she isn't busy enough, Madalena also helps to create employment for women in Timor through an organization called Faluk Hadomi Timor for the widows in the former combatants. They make and sell tais, a traditional form of weaving in Timor that they turn into bags and wallets and other goods sold at the tourist markets.
I founded the organization and involved my friends to produce the handicrafts in order to gain money for our daily needs. I always motivate them so they can do it on their own without being dependent to others.
A national hero and an inspiring peace activist, Madalena has long been committed to Timor-Leste. For Asia Calling KBR, this report was produced by Theodesia Dos Reis in Dili, Timor-Leste.
Thousands of asylum seekers live here in this village in West Java. Chisarua is also home to Mina Asadi. Born in Afghanistan, Mina is from the ethnic Hazara minority, a community that has been frequently targeted by the Taliban, and more recently by groups aligned with the Islamic State. Mina and her parents fled to Pakistan to escape the civil war when she was 12 years old. Now 24, Mina is petite, but she's a karate champion. In 2010, Mina was a member of Pakistan's national team for the Asian Games in Bangladesh.
I have 38 gold medal also from Bangladesh, from Pakistan, from Afghanistan.
Mina practiced karate in the Pakistani city of Quetta, but she longed to return home to Afghanistan and represent her own country. That never happened. Her family was forced to flee the violence in Pakistan after first fleeing Afghanistan. And that's how Mina ended up here in Indonesia 2 years ago.
The situation of Afghanistan day by day is bad. Mm-hmm. And that's why I came in here. And also especially for me, because I was famous on Afghanistan, and they know, all of the people know me. Mm-hmm. And also in Pakistan, all of the people know me. Mm-hmm. And also how you are saying, you know, mosque. Mullah Chinga?
Imam.
They said about me that it's not good, and especially for ladies.
Mina fled with her husband, daughter, and mother-in-law. They had to pay people smugglers to fly them to Indonesia, about $5,000 for each adult. Her husband, Ashraf Jawari, told me they travelled from India to Malaysia and then to Indonesia on an Afghani passport and an illegal visa. To seek asylum, they first have to be granted official refugee status by the United Nations Agency for Refugees, a process that can and often does take many years. And that's before their claims are sent to countries that might be willing to host them. Unable to work or study, Mina still relies on savings and remittances from her relatives back at home. To drive away her boredom, she teaches karate to the children of refugees three times a week. It's a tough wait for now, but Mina says she still dreams of being a world karate champion.
When I go from Indonesia to another country, I should show myself to all of the world that I can. And one Afghani girl can become a champion.
This report was produced by Radhika Wijaya in Chisarua, West Java. Chandra Wawaruntu is graceful and dignified. As I wait for her, she's greeting dozens of people who are telling her that they are humbled by her courage. Chandra says she's driven to tell her story publicly, but that if I notice her fidgeting or stammering, it might be because she's having flashbacks, memories of a devastating chapter in her life.
I came from a wealthy family, and I graduated
from a wealthy family. Chandra Wawaruntu received a good education, which led to a good career at a bank.
Work in the bank as a money market trader. And also
that's until the Asian financial crisis hit in 1997, massively devaluing the rupiah and causing her job to be axed. With a three-year-old daughter to support, Chandra looked further afield for work. That's when she saw an ad in Compass, a reputable Indonesian newspaper.
And then I saw a newspaper. The ad said 6 months work in U.S., Singapore, Hong Kong, Malaysia, Japan, something like that. So I decided to go to U.S. because of I know the power of U.S. dollar.
Chandra went through all the legitimate channels and left Indonesia with a plan to work in hospitality.
So I paid $3,000 as requirement for employment fee. I went to the U.S. embassy and I got my visa. I flew to the U.S. So arrival was smooth, and someone have my picture and recognized me. And are you Chandra? I say yes.
But as soon as she arrived, things quickly deviated from the plan and became a nightmare.
I didn't go to Chicago as a promise. He took me to somewhere, and I was exchanged with money. And I counted, it was five times. After that, with the gunpoint, because of I refused to open my clothes, he sent me to a brothel that ran by a lady trafficker. He said, "Mama Sang, a new girl." So I realized it was a disaster that I was sold in the brothel for prostitution. And then I couldn't do anything because of the gunpoint, and I saw a security with a baseball bat swinging around the bat, and I saw a little girl beaten by those people, and she was bleeding, and I saw untreated wounded on her face. That made me so scared.
And the nightmare just kept rolling.
Few hours after my arrival, I was sold to sex buyer. In the morning, my trafficker took my passport and my return ticket and also my belongings. They said I had to pay $30,000 to be free from the job because they gave me that job. That's what he said. So every customer that I serve will deduct $100 from the debt. So it means I have to serve 300 sex buyers. So I think hard about the situation. I think they will not free me. They will not let me go.
Days became nights and nights became day, all filled with the blinding lights of casinos and the revolving doors of endless hotel rooms.
Candy, my name was taken. So they changed my name to be Candy.
Chandra doesn't know exactly how long this continued. Eventually, in desperation, she jumped out a bathroom window.
So I tried to escape many times. And then by jumping out from second floor bathroom windows, I was alive and still alive. It was amazing. It was a miracle. I stayed away, I ran from that place, and I called this number in the morning.
Seeking help from a contact she'd been given, Chandra was tricked. And soon she was back in the hands of organized crime and at the brothel. Chandra wasn't free until she escaped for a second time. She went to the police and the Indonesian consulate seeking help. But both turned her away. They didn't believe her story. She was living on the streets, telling her story to anyone who would listen.
Finally, I met a U.S. Navy at the park, and he said he will help me. And he called FBI.
The FBI verified her story and closed down the brothel she had been at. She was able to get her visa to legally stay in the country. So she moved into a shelter and started an English as a second language course and went to school. But Chandra was driven to work towards a world where what happened to her would never happen again. Chandra has an NGO called Mentari, based in New York and LA. Mentari works with survivors of human trafficking and sexual slavery.
So we empower them to get the job and also how to open bank account, how to shop, where to go, when we go to hospital, what to do, like life survival. Because most of the people that brought to the United States didn't know how to survive in the United States.
Mentari also has links with partner organizations in Indonesia, where they are raising awareness of human trafficking and supporting survivors. For Asia Calling, this is Nicole Kirby in conversation with Chandra Wawaruntu in Ubud, Bali.
To hear more of Asia Calling, visit the website kbr.id/AsiaCalling/English. To hear Wings programs again, email wings@wings.org or visit our page at facebook.com/wingsradio. We appreciate all our supporters, including your local community radio station, Suzette Cullen, and Genevieve Vaughn, author of the book The Gift in the Heart of Language. The Wings sound logo is from Libana's album A Circle is Cast. I'm Frieda Worden. This is the Women's International News Gathering Service.